Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 98 years ago in 1927, the Carolina Theater opened its doors for the first time with the showing of the silent movie A Kiss in a Taxi. Like so many movie palaces of the day, it was just that, luxurious. And at least while the lights were up, theatergoers were surrounded by the theater's sheer beauty, featuring wrought-iron chandeliers, intricate murals, and stately balconies. The Carolina Theater was where many people saw the most important films of the day. The theater holds the distinction of screening Julie Andrews' The Sound of Music more than any other theater in the world. But people around the region filled the seats for live performances, too. Elvis made an appearance here in 1956, but Elvis has long since left the building, and in fact, the building has been closed since 1978, much of its beauty long since gone. And so it sat for decades, even as efforts to restore it were ongoing. In the early 80s, it was placed on the local historic register. In the mid-80s, the city bought the property and then, in 2012, deeded it to the Foundation for the Carolinas. They have been feverishly raising money, designing the new interior, and working tirelessly to reopen Carolina Theater. And now, those efforts are about to bear fruit. This hour, a sneak preview of the magnificent work that has been done here. We're actually sitting on the stage at the Carolina Theater, which makes this the first performance. So Kathy Bessant is with us. She is CEO and president of Foundation for the Carolinas. Good to see you again.
Great to see you, Mike. Thanks.
Thank you for letting us in. Sean Seifert is the Carolina Theater's executive director, and Douglas Young is the theater's programming director. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
So let's start. You were on this program, Kathy, about a year and a couple of months ago. We were actually taping this before you opened the building, but you were on this program just over a year ago, and I asked you about the impending opening of this theater, and you couldn't answer because renovations were still underway, and they continued. They're continuing right now as we speak. There was a ribbon cutting earlier this week. And the public has been invited to walk around after that ribbon cutting to see this magical transformation. When is the official opening? What is the first event on this stage?
Well, Mike, first of all, thanks for having us. And I'm so excited. Actually, I can't think of a better first performance than having you here. So I appreciate that. And I think, make a prognostication when I was with you before that it would be open by the end of the year. And in fact, this is not the end of the year, but I can say with absolute conviction and truth that all construction was done by the end of the year. And what you're seeing now is the finer touches and the things that any homeowner would do literally before they invited people to their home for the first time. This is an amazing place. And the first time the public will get to see it will begin the week of March 24th. And so we're really looking forward to having public eye on it. And we have donor previews scheduled. The symphony will be here. We have programming scheduled, really, and Douglas can talk about this. We have a lot of programming scheduled, heavy demand. But the first real time the public will see the building and there will be ticketed events will be this week and going forward.
So the symphony will be here on the 28th of March. And there's a significance to this because the symphony, as I understand it, played its very first performance in this building. When? What year was that?
1932.
Wow. So they're coming back to help you open this building. The Foundation for the Carolinas, of course, Kathy, as you know, is focused on philanthropy and on serving as a catalyst for philanthropy. And I'm just curious where this, the Carolina Theater, fits into that mission.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, we are about inspiring great philanthropy and really remarkable philanthropy, other words we use inside the foundation. We're also about civic leadership. And as you said rightly in the opening, this was a property that people had tried to restore for decades. And when the first time I walked in here to tour it with Michael Marsicano and Harvey Gantt and Hugh McCall, we were standing in rubble, literal rubble. And so at the point at which we made the decision to take the city up on its offer and to purchase for $1 the building, it was a project no one else would take on. And the reason for that is it took courage. We knew it would take courage over a long period of time. It took resources that the public sector nor would any other body have the capability to generate. And we knew that it would take persistence, you know, leadership over a long period of time and just the flat bulldogged refusal to not get it done. So it fits into philanthropy and to civic leadership because it was catalytic. Nobody else would take it on. It attracted donors and resources out of the private sector in ways that we never even envisioned at the start. You know, I think we started out with a budget of $51 million, and we'll close out the books whenever we do in terms of a capital investment of almost $90 million in this space. And that's due to generous donors in the city and the state. So it was all of those things. And the reason it's civic leadership is because, if not us, who in that moment?
This building is kind of a miracle, because when you walk in from the outside and you walk into this auditorium, it is I cannot stress this enough. It is breathtaking. It is stunning. This is the most beautiful theater this city has ever seen. And when you're sitting on the stage looking out, it is equally stunning. It's beautiful. But it was closed for 47 years. That's the other part of this miracle. Why didn't the wrecking ball meet it?
Well, there were several attempts to do that over time, there's been stalwart leadership across Charlotte and the region, almost to the point of, you know, citizens barring the door from the wrecking ball. I'm not certain that's literal, but it certainly is fair figuratively. And so I think it was the will of the people, the Friends of the Carolina Theater, the other historic preservation organizations that just said, this can't happen. Now, you don't want to walk into a building that's been sitting for 47 years. And by the way, life has moved forward in those 47 years. So technology, even the size of the seats and the size of the audience, very different than 100, let alone 50 years ago.
And that is why Sean is here. Because Sean, she talked about walking in here with Harvey Gantt and people like that, seeing it for the first time and being in the midst of rubble. And I did a show in this theater with Till Schmidt-Rimpler and his Moving Poets years ago. It was, I think, Dracula or something, which was a perfect setting for it because there were no seats. There was nothing on the walls. The stage was several feet higher than it is now. It was nothing but cement and mold. Perfect setting for that show. But I'm just curious, what happened to everything in the original theater? Why was it completely stripped of its decoration?
Well, what's interesting about this theater is that over the years, it was always state-of-the-art. It had always, when sound came out, it always had the newest state-of-the-art sound. When movies became wider screen and bigger screen, it was at the forefront of doing bigger and wider screens. And what I've learned through this restoration process, as people come out of the woodwork and become more involved in it because they have stories to tell, like all the plaster work around the organ lofts, that wasn't removed at the end. That was removed in the 60s when they went with a new wider screen, and they hung curtains, green curtains, all over the inside walls of the theater. And that all that plaster work made the curtains wrinkle and not hang right, so they ripped all the plaster work off. Now, there's several other iterations that's happened since then. For example, we had City Fair. There was a group, when City Fair was around, they were going to turn this into a dance club or some sort of club like that. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, a lot of the old seats were taken out. A lot of the, what light fixtures we did have, those were taken out. So really, over the years, it just kept getting stripped more and more.
So is there anybody alive today who may have seen this theater in its original configuration?
That would have probably had to have been in the 50s.
Okay. So if you saw it in its original configuration, how does this compare to that?
This is close in some ways, but it's nicer in others, in that there's very few photos of the inside of this theater in its original state. Mm-hmm. Most of those are black and white. Like when our plaster restorers came in, they're about the best in the industry. Evergreen Arts. They came in and they scraped the paint off, tried to find what the original colors were where they could. But again, with black and white photos and very few of them, it was really hard to get the exact match.
Yeah.
So through history and research and Evergreen Arts looking back in their archives, they've created what we've got here today.
So you and I took a tour of this building a couple of months ago when people were still on the stage working and things like that. And think painters were still painting. And the Foundation for the Carolinas took this over in 2012. And here we sit 13 years later. And everybody wants to know, what took so long? What's been going on in this building for 13 years?
Well, that's really interesting because a lot of it is you have an old building. So you have a building that closed in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
40 years between that closing and when construction restarted. So you have a leaky roof, you have lead paint, you have asbestos, you have dry cleaning fluid in the ground. So all of that stuff comes to bear when you start digging new foundations and getting in there to clean everything up. One of the biggest things that really kind of threw the team back generally is as you get into behind the scenes, behind the plaster work, behind the brick, where we had to make modifications to allow for new technology, new HVAC systems that take more space, stuff like that, we found that the steel structure, the lath behind the plaster, just was all dilapidated, rusting away. So all of that, what we thought was good at the beginning, it looked like, hey, there's a good wall, we can use that. When in fact, we had to tear it all down and start
this
all
is,
over.
This is like those home improvement shows where you get in, you buy the house, you're going to flip it, and you find out that nothing, if everything is rotten behind the cosmetic walls. Let's talk for a moment about why, Kathy. What makes this building historically significant? Why go to all the trouble? Why spend $90 million to bring it back?
Well, first of all, I think all great cities have a historic theater. I grew up in the Midwest. There's a great historic theater on State Street in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There's a great historic theater, the Fox Theater in downtown Detroit. There are theaters all over the Carolinas in cities that are historic theaters. So I think it's a mark of all great cities that figure out a way to honor their history and honor their future at the same time. So I think it's important because it's part of the fabric of what makes us great. I also think that this is an opportunity for the next generation of theater goers or people that come to engage in civic discourse to see what it looked like in the past. And so as much as it was a restoration, and Sean really aptly described all the hard work, this is as much, with modern updates, this is as much of what the theater would have looked like in its heyday as it could possibly have looked like.
And it does fit into your mission at the Foundation because you are all about community and communal experiences. And hearkening back to this year's Academy Awards, where somebody said, go see movies in theaters because that's what they were intended for. And it's a different experience sitting with 150, 200 other people. The same is true when you're doing live shows, when you're doing lectures, getting together in a building at the same time with other people. And that's what this will serve, correct?
Absolutely. 50% of our programming, 50% will be civic, community-based, or discourse learning-based programming. I hope there are lots of panels like the one we have sitting here where people discuss important issues in front of a widely varied audience with various opinions.
Kathy Bessant is the CEO and president of the Foundation for the Carolinas. They are opening the Carolina Theater. We're here with Sean Seifert, the executive director, and Douglas Young is in charge of programming. And we're going to talk when we come back about what happened here over the years when it was a working theater. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We are coming to you today from the stage of the Carolina Theater, which opens this week. It is a stunning recreation of what theaters used to be like in the past. And we are sitting on the stage with Kathy Bessant. She's the CEO and president of the Foundation for the Carolinas. They are the people responsible with their donors for bringing this back. Sean Seifert is the executive director of this building, and Douglas Young is the program director. This is historic not only because it is an historic building and it's been restored to its historic beauty, Douglas. It's also historic for what was on these stages, or on this stage. Elvis Presley played here in 1956. It was a movie palace. It was a vaudeville house. So what other acts made that we may have known?
You know, I think that one of the things that's easy to overlook is when this building opened in 1927, it was, as you said, a vaudeville house, but it was also a silent picture palace. Mm-hmm. Because talking films had not even been invented yet. That didn't happen until the end of 27, until The Jazz Singer came out. But over the years, there were live performances that happened here, as they had a mixture during the week of films and then performances, live performances. They had a mixture of that going back and forth. And it was all about bringing the community together. Now, what we forget sometimes is we think of this theater opening as being this great palace, and it was. It opened in 27, but there was another theater just down the street. The Imperial was here. There was another theater down the street on Tryon, which also showed films. Now, they didn't have a vaudeville stage like this theater did, but this theater brought people in a different way. And actually, when it opened, it had seating for 1,450 people.
Where?
In really the same space. But as we pointed out earlier, yeah, some things have changed over the years. And one of the things is that we have grown into larger seats. Originally, when this facility opened, it only had restrooms on one level. It had, and for the men, they have two stalls and two stalls for the ladies for 1,450 people. Mm. Luckily, we've made improvements on
yes,
that.
That's one of the things that we'll talk about, that bringing this building up to code, modern-day code. Did the big bands play on the stage? Did Bob Hope play here? Am I right
Bob
about that?
Bob Hope did play here. I recently learned Frank Sinatra played here. The Elvis appearance, he played here in February of 1956. He had four sold-out shows.
Wow.
Mother Maybelle Carter was also on the bill for that performance. And there were a number of artists who would come through town. Of course, around 1955 is when Ovens Auditorium and Charlotte Coliseum opened up. And about the time that happened, that's when most of the live entertainment started moving over to that early edition of a performing arts center.
And I mentioned, well, I didn't mention this, but in 1978, November 27th, 1978, was the last showing of a movie before they closed the doors on it. It was Bruce Lee's The Fist. Now, there's a movie to remember. But this theater holds the distinction, if I'm not mistaken, of running the film The Sound of Music more than any other theater in the world.
That Why? Is correct.
How is that possible? Why?
It really spoke to the people in 64 and 65. It ran for about 80 weeks, which seems incredible, but it played to over 400,000 people, which was larger than the population in the community. One of the things I think that's really phenomenal about that is the performer, director, writer, Charles Randolph Wright, recently shared a story. Charles grew up in York, South Carolina, and he has such a great fondness for this space because, having grown up in the area, his family brought him to see Sound of Music here because this was one of the first theaters that had been desegregated. So the impact of seeing right. that with other people on the same levels was just such an important thing, and that's a large part of our DNA. It's about building into the community and providing a place where all people can come together.
There's a movie screen right behind us on this stage. Any plans to show The Sound of Music here again?
I can go out on a limb and say, yes, we will be showing, and it'll probably be a sing-along edition, but actually we won't be showing it on that screen. We even have a larger screen.
Okay.
So we will include films as part of our programming, yes.
So everything in here, Kathy, except for the bones, and even some of the bones, I suppose, looks new. It is state-of-the-art, and we're going to talk about what that means in a moment. But this looks like a theater that might have been around in 1920, and that was the idea. And in theaters in 1920 were special places because the world was smaller, people's experiences were less, and when they went to a movie or a show, It was a big deal. So the place needed to be big and welcoming and reflective of luxury, et cetera, et cetera. But making this space look like this was really hard. In fact, you say it's harder to make new things look old than it is to make old things look new. I think you succeeded. So having walked in here with Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt to see the rubble, when you walked in here to see this for the first time, what was your reaction?
Oh, I cried. Easy to say. I've seen it over the last 18 months up close and personal, probably walked through it a couple of times over the previous years during the restoration as a member of the board of the foundation. But it is to know the incredible vision that it took, and I credit Michael Marsicano with this incredible artistic vision about what the future could be for this theater. So to just be in awe of the vision and then to be in awe of those who could actually make it happen and to have seen what people do. You will never hear the stories of people who spent all weekend cleaning up something that had gone wrong with construction or dealing with power surges that would take power out during construction, not just of this building, but our building next door. You'll never hear, even though I just told them, you'll never hear those stories but walking in here and knowing the souls of the people and the vision that was brought to it, I literally cried.
So when you do any kind of renovation on any building, you have to make sure that it's up to code, Sean, present day code. This building was built in the 20s. It was nowhere near present day code. Was it near 20s code? I think you told me a story that you discovered some things that would not have probably passed muster even then.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, specifically like stairways and stuff like that, where each step doesn't match the other. You know, a lot of those things are what we take for granted now. That was kind of, you know, standard fare back in the day. So there's just a lot of things like that. Now, some of those stairs still do exist because we still do have a historic theater. And like, for example, the balcony still has stairs that are 1927 stairs. Because if we change that, the balcony wouldn't be where it is today. It would be all the way at the stage to get the proper steps in there. So, and it just wouldn't work. So there's a lot of history here that is in place. It stays in place, and that's just how it works.
You talked about the need to remove lead paint, and I'm sure you found asbestos that had to be removed. There was contaminated water. You mentioned dry cleaning fluid. I don't even want to know why that was anywhere near this building. But you encountered a lot of surprises along the way. This stage is lower than it was when I first saw it because, as you mentioned, when they put City Fair in, this was going to be a nightclub, so the floor was going to be flat from the lobby to the stage, so they raised it to make that happen. But when you decided to put it back where it belongs, you went downstairs under it and found out some things that needed to be really drastically changed.
Right. So the stage house, a 1927 stage house, it's close to, I believe, 80 or 90 feet tall, just made out of brick. It had a little bit of steel in it, but it in no way meets current code. So when we knew we had to lower the stage, we ripped the stage out, but we had to put in footers for the new steelwork that the engineers wanted to put in the stage house. So in order to do that, we had to bring excavators into the space and dig down about 30 feet into raw dirt, put in new foundations, and put in all new steel for the stage house to help hold it up and meet code.
So was there any point in time where any of you just looked at each other and said, is this really worth it?
I'm not certain we ever said, is this really worth it? I think we said, is this impossible? Have we hit a point where execution of the vision isn't possible? And every time, you know, you can see from the spirit of the people you're talking to and the spirit of the people, the hundreds of people who've worked on this, every time the answer to that was, this is possible, and we're going to go for it.
Because I suppose you could have torn the building down and built it up and made it look like this when you, why not do that?
Well, a new build certainly would have been easier, mm-hmm. and it would have been less expensive. My husband turned to me during the Academy Awards, and he said, CCATH, they only spent $70 million to renovate the Egyptian Theater. What are you thinking? And I said, they didn't restore the theater. They renovated the theater. Uh-huh. Those, again, as you said very well, those are two different things. So there were several gut check moments along the way, several thought times that we thought about alternatives, bringing in partners or perhaps selling pieces of it in order to figure out how to get it done. But each time we said, holding to the vision means we've got to do it, and we can gather the resources. And we had generous donors who saw the vision as well.
So this theater, for people who don't know where we are, This theater is on Tryon Street. It's between 6th Street and 5th Street on the east side of Tryon Street. The facade, the marquee, the entrance, used to be at the sidewalk. It is no longer at the sidewalk. You completely disassembled it, put it in storage, and when this was all done, you have re-erected it just outside the auditorium doors here, but it's inside a 4,000-square-foot lobby, the entire facade that used to sit on Tryon Street. Why did you decide to do that?
First of all, I think that you may have worked on the project yourself. You know so much about it, which is great.
That's thanks to Sean, who took me through here.
I hope everyone knows and embraces so much about it. You know, the reality of life on the curb is very different than the reality of life further off the curb. Mm-hmm. And so whether we're avoiding air conditions or eliminating or, you know, getting in the way of pedestrian traffic or even preserving a delicate facade over the years, it was really important to keep it off the street. And yet we needed to do something really special architecturally to highlight that marquee, make it visible from the street so it wasn't lost. And the sign is out on the street. But that's really the reason for that creation, to protect the fragility of what we have.
Yeah, it's in this glass box that when all the signage is taken down to hide the construction, you'll be able to see the facade from the street and the electric sign, which is a faithful recreation of the actual marquee that was there, although it's been modernized and it's electrified. It's electronicified, it has a TV screen on it, essentially is the easy way to say it. But when you walk into the lobby, Sean, you're in the 21st century. It's very modern. You see this old facade.
Exactly.
You walk through the doors, and you walk into this space, this auditorium. It knocks your socks off. It is not what you expect. So is what you see when you walk into this auditorium with the frescoes and the guild and all the plaster work and the curtain that has prisms on it, etc. Is that what moviegoers and theatergoers would have experienced when they walked into this space in 1928?
Yes, for the most part. I mean, this is how they decorated theaters back in the day. This is how they build them. You know, we have some newer lights and some newer gadgets here and there, but for the most part, this has the same wow factor that they had back in the day.
Yeah, the attention to detail in here is amazing. Right down to the crystal prisms that are on this front curtain here and the carvings and the gold leaf and somehow the colors that you chose throughout this building, because you said you didn't really know what the original colors were in some cases. It just all works together as a unit. As you look at it, it's a sea of, what color is this? Silver, I guess, the seating?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And a combination of single seats and banquettes, and you have cocktail seating in the balcony with individual chairs and tables. How do you envision all of this being used? This is not completely traditional.
Right. And one of the neat things about this is because we're a civic gathering space, we wanted to have different seating to allow people to maybe gather, talk a little bit differently than they normally do. You know, the new theaters now, they even have bigger seats and you're almost divided from the person beside you. Here you can sit arm to arm, you know, depending on who you're with. And it kind of fosters a more of a community feel, we think.
You have really successfully married the past to the present with planning for the future, which seems to be Herculean, or Herculean, I think is how you're supposed to say it. In doing so, have you set a new standard?
I think so. You know, it's one thing to put some technology in a theater. It's another thing to just restore a theater. You know, as you know, a lot of restored theaters, similar age as this, the lighting is all exposed. You see all the new lighting that they put in because there's no place to put it. And you can see where they're trying to put new technology in an old theater. Here, we painstakingly tried to hide it all. So you don't see all the lights that are shining on us right now on the stage. They're hidden kind of behind the scenes. And that's the way the sound and the audio and the video, all of that stuff is all hidden with behind the walls, so you don't see it. So when you come in, it's a historic theater, but when we turn it on, hang on.
And I said it was state of the art. So what does that mean to you as somebody who worked on this project from the beginning and who understands all the technical aspects in terms of lighting and the sound, et cetera? What does state of the art mean?
Well, really, it's the newest and the latest. So, you know, you can go with the basics. Our sound system is some of the best you get, best you can get. One of the kind of the goals we wanted to have is we had a good enough sound system so a band could come here, plug in, and play. We don't have to rent more equipment. We don't have to, you know, do any of that. That makes it easier for groups to come in and use the space. So we have a great sound system. We have surround sound with center channel speakers for movies. We can do a blockbuster movie just like any other theater can do. Mm. So that's easy. You know, that's the sound. That's the easy part. We have, of course, a movie projector, so we can do movies all day long. But some of the things that kind of stretch this a little bit is we have a projection mapping system that uses 6 laser projectors. And we can project over 180 degrees in the audience chamber from floor to ceiling on the walls. And this allows us to put on interactive content, or we can transport you to the middle of the jungle, or we can do amazing things to not only just tell the story from the stage, but to bring it all the way to the seats.
So you have these frescoes on the wall, because there were frescoes on the wall of this theater originally, and they were actually frescoes, which means they were painted into the plaster. These are not. I'm going to come back to that in a second. But you have all these things that are reminiscent of the old way of doing things and what people expected. And if you go to New York and you go to an old theater in New York, you see this kind of work in those theaters. But you've stepped it up. These frescoes are not frescoes. They're hiding something technical that when we come back, I want to talk about, because you plan to use these in many different ways. We're on the stage at the Carolina Theater, which opens this week after many, many, many years of being empty. And it is beautiful, and we can't do it justice on the radio. Take our word for it, but then come out and see it. We're going to come right back with Kathy Bessant, Sean Seaford, and Douglas Young in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're on the stage at the Carolina Theater, vacant, closed, a derelict for 47 years, and because I'm here, it's still a derelict. No, I'm just kidding. It's been completely redone. Kathy Bessant is one of the moving forces behind this. She's the CEO and president of Foundation for the Carolinas. She and her predecessor have really put a lot of effort into making this theater come alive again. Sean Seaford is the executive director of the theater, and Douglas Young will be responsible for putting things on the stage here, performances, etc. So we talked about the decorations that are in this stunning auditorium, and these frescoes that used to be painted onto the walls, they're not paintings. What are they?
So what those are is those are fabric. The paintings were originally done 1/3 the size by artists. We scanned them and then blew them up and printed them on a special fabric, and that fabric has sound deadening panels behind it. So what that allows us to do is increase the acoustic efficiency of the theater, making it sound better than it ever has. One of the other things we did is the plaster that's underneath the balcony on the ceiling. Some of that is acoustic plaster, and that's a special plaster that also absorbs sound, but it still looks like plaster.
And you have kind of, I think you told me that you future-proofed this building technologically. I suppose you can only go so far, because gosh knows what's coming in the 22nd century, but right. Should this building be here then, how have you done it so that it will be able to be used that way?
Yeah, so all of the wiring is state-of-the-art. Of course, we can use wiring for a long period of time. But then every location, there's locations throughout this auditorium that you don't see that has fiber optics. We have fiber optics everywhere. So we're future-proofing as much as we can, not knowing what the future is. You know, at some point in time, maybe there's going to be a holograph here on the stage. We don't know. But a lot of the wiring and a lot of the stuff in the walls and the conduit runs allow future new entertainment options. All that's kind of in place.
So this Theater Douglas has about 906 seats, and it's questionable about how many people it actually will seat, because on these banquettes that you have scattered throughout the upper and lower deck, depending upon the size of the individuals occupying those banquettes, that could change the seating. How do you intend to use it? How do you intend how would you know how many tickets you have to sell?
Well, it will depend on the event and the configuration on stage. Mm-hmm. We have many different configurations built. One of the unique things about this theater is it was really designed to be used in a variety of different ways. We're sitting currently on the stage facing the audience. And if we look out in the center section of the house, the first 10 rows or so have three seats in the middle that can be completely taken out, leaving the rest of the seats there. So if you wanted to have, let's say, a wedding in this theater, and as a person who got married on the stage of the Carolina Theater in Greensboro in 1996, I'm a fan of that, you could actually just walk right down the middle of the aisle and have your wedding here. You could also put up platforms and have a runway for a fashion show. The thinking that went into this space is really next level in terms of what can we do as opposed to what can't we do.
And there's an orchestra pit, and the floor of the orchestra pit goes up and down, so it can come up to the stage level, it can go down to the pit level, and it can also be at the auditorium level and other levels. How do you see that being used?
It will vary. We know that the symphony will be in here with Renee Fleming. They'll be on stage for that performance, but they'll be joining us for another performance in which they will be in the pit. Sometimes we'll want to bring that pit up, and that will reduce the capacity by 29 seats, but that will extend the stage so that we can get further into the house. With the banquettes, we know that on every single banquette, we can at least get a minimum of 6 people, but the joke we have internally is, how well do you like the people you're with? It could be 8. It could be 10. Yeah. And for some of our groups, we will allow them to have that flexibility.
And it's not just this space in which we're sitting, in this auditorium and on the stage. There are other spaces in this theater.
There are. When we open the theater, there will be additional spaces that we haven't fully built out yet. But as you pointed out, that lobby is a spectacular lobby.
Right.
And I know some people refer to it as a glass box, but to me, I think the intention was to create full transparency, much in the direction of the foundation. And that's, you know, where our DNA comes from in terms of bringing the community together. That glass is fully transparent, and when we take all of that covering off, it will be as if there's no glass there. So it's as if there's no barriers for the people on the outside to come in.
This city has the good fortune of having, I think, more theaters per square block than New York, or just about the same, because right down the street we have the Belk Theater and the Booth Playhouse and the Stage Door Theater, all part of the Blumenthal. And further down the street is the Knight Theater, part of the Blumenthal. Right down the street the other way, you have the Children's Theater that has two auditoriums. When Spirit Square has been reconstructed, the plan is, at least, to bring back the McGlowan Theater. And here you are in the middle of it. How do you see, there's a lot of competition. We have a lot of available space, a lot of available seats. How do you see programming this, Douglas, to make people come here and to make performers come here as opposed to some of these other places?
Well, I think we're taking a different approach that really, again, leans into what the Foundation for the Carolinas does for the community. We're not here to compete with anyone. We're here to enhance the offerings. And we'll do that in a little bit different way when it comes to venue management. Some venue managers will just open up their facility and rent out their space. That's one great model of doing it. Some will actually do a combination in which they rent out space or have resident companies or even present or produce programming themselves. We will partner with the community in most everything that we do. Even when we present shows ourselves, we will be looking for people to partner with, because our goal is to make people have the opportunity, or our goal is rather to have an opportunity for everyone in the community to come in here. So we'll be using a wide variety of programming to do that. Now, there are a lot of other great offerings that are happening. And so we are trying to be very cognizant of what other people are doing, because we don't want to, you know, step on anyone's toes who are already doing things. The size of the stage means, because it was a vaudeville house originally, we'll never do Broadway shows in here. And that's totally great, because Blumenthal Performing Arts does a great job of doing that, and they have great venues to do that in. But we'll be able to do some things that are a little bit different in terms of bringing in thought leaders and having conversations, as we mentioned earlier, in terms of the community. How can we connect? One of the things we'll be doing early on is hosting the kickoff event for Charlotte Shout this year. The Charlotte Ideas Festival has a speaker coming in that the foundation has been a part of sponsoring, Noelle Russell, and she'll be talking about AI. Those kind of conversations will be so exciting. And during the course of Charlotte Shout, we'll be having a number of events going on here that will include Jay Ward, our city's poet laureate. He's launched his beautiful new project. This is a celebration of Black neighborhoods called Black Charlotte. And they just dropped that album a few weeks ago, and we'll be hosting the first performance since then. But we'll be partnering with the Gantt Center and with Charlotte Shout to do that.
Years ago, thanks in large part to Bank of America and Hugh McCall's efforts, North Tryon was kind of the bustling part of town. When you went to South Tryon, it was Firestone, the tire shop, and a couple of things. And the reverse is now true. South Tryon, everything south of Trade Street now, it seems to be that's where the museums are, that's where the Night Theater is. That seems to be the happening side of town. But this is the Carolina Theater at Bilk Place. You've renamed it. You've christened it. You're going to have a revitalized Spirit Square a block away from you. How does this fit into whatever they're trying to do with North Tryon?
Well, I think you know that there's, and the community knows, there's been a North Tryon vision plan in place for some time. And when construction in this renovation began, there was no library renovation project underway. There wasn't a Dubois Center further down the street. There wasn't the UNC Charlotte CoLab as a cornerstone of the tech hub on North Tryon. So the role of the theater and its partners on this corner, including Discovery Place, even come together to sort of balance in a very good way, in a non-competitive way, but balance everything from South End to NoDa. And that's really the point. There's been a lot of need to revitalize the North Tryon end of town, and the ballet, the McCall Center, you know, what was connecting them to the rest of uptown. And I think that the momentum that you're seeing is right in line with that original North Tryon vision plan and is very, very exciting. We think that you know, the further we push development and the further we push the combination of entertainment, dining, retail, education, lodging, the better we are as a total uptown, end to end.
I have to ask an uncomfortable question. The Foundation of the Carolinas helps people guide their philanthropic dollars to places where it can be best used, and that's also served the intent of the people leaving that money behind and putting it to good use. People are going to be asking. There are a lot of needs in this city. Could this money, this $90 million, have been put to better use?
I think that's a fair question, Mike, in any use of funds, whether it was the use of funds for the NASCAR Hall of Fame or for stadium construction or arena construction, or whether it's funds for the ballet or anything else. It's a fair question, because money is a zero-sum game in the end. That said, I think the balance in Charlotte is really important. And so the funders that were committed not only to the arts, which would be the easy answer, which would be to say a city needs great art. No question that we need great arts. But the better answer and the more accurate answer is we needed a space that our donors saw uniquely as convening civic engagement focusing on emerging artists and small group and small theater and theatrical performance, really activity that can only be undertaken in a philanthropic way. And so could the dollars be used somewhere else? Our donors use their dollars lots of places all the time, and it's true with any use of funds. But I do believe that we're honoring the uniqueness of the niche we have here, and I do believe that our donors saw that this was something they could do that was different than anything else. Most of the donors that you will see when we open the theater, this is not their only plaque on the wall. These are incredibly generous donors who donate over a wide range of things and causes, and so I'm left with the conclusion, and I'm analytical, so I think about these things that way, but I draw my own conclusion that, and I think a fair conclusion, that the money is well spent and in the fabric of where other money is spent, well positioned, well placed.
Talk to me just for a second about the mission of the foundation. What is the mission?
We say the mission is remarkable philanthropy. And that's meant to encapsulate the two things we do that are most important, which are to create philanthropic capacity through our donors, through the attraction, excellent management, and advice and counsel for the disbursement of funds. But as you and I have talked about before, it's our donors who decide where right. those funds go. So remarkable philanthropy, and what makes it remarkable is what it enables us to do in the form of civic leadership, to take on things as we've done over the years. You can look back through our website in its earliest forms, and you'll see the Carolina Thread Trail, and you'll see some of the other things that have been created from the aggregation of philanthropy.
So, Douglas, you have said that this theater, through its programming, will mirror the values of the foundation. So when you're, as the person who is essentially programming what's on the stage, booking the act, what are you looking for to match that mission?
At the end of the day, our goal is to curate content that cultivates community. And we'll use a lot of different mixes of programming to do that. Yes, we'll use some arts, we'll use some entertainment, we'll use some films.
Right.
But we will use conversations.
And you've done this for a long time. You've done this job for other organizations for a long time, and you are responsible for bringing a lot of performers and performances to Charlotte that perhaps this city would not have been exposed to had it not been for your eagle eye. I know that the symphony is here on March 28th, and they're bringing with them Renee Fleming, who is a superstar in every way. How do you top that? What are you looking for to continue to fill that stage with that caliber?
Well, you know, the next night, we're so excited, actually, I have to say, that the symphony is bringing Renee Fleming in, not only because she's a fantastic international artist, not only because it's a return for the symphony. You know, they were here in March of 1932 to do their first performance. It's not only a homecoming for them, but the next night we're giving a stage to a couple of artists who have a connection to this area. We want to give them a platform as well, because it's really easy, I think, to sometimes recognize great artists in other places. So we're bringing in Mark and Maggie O'Connor, the Grammy Award winners, and they're performing with the Vega Quartet, who and together they're doing a programming called Beethoven and Bluegrass, which they will be debuting at Carnegie Hall just 1 month later.
Wow. The Foundation for the Carolinas was the catalyst behind making this happen. When the city sold this building to you for a dollar, I think, Kathy, you said that you may have overpaid. but since then, you've spent $90 million. So once it's open, once it's up and running, I have less than a minute left. What will be the foundation's involvement with this theater?
Well, first of all, we're neighbors, and we share a common vision. We expect programming to happen in both buildings, sometimes at the same time, meaning start in one place and move to another. So we'll be partners in a better North Tryon, better community, and great partnership.
Sean, I know that you've been involved in this since the very near the very beginning and making all of this come to fruition and making it as beautiful as it is, and you have accomplished it, so congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Sean Seifert is the executive director of the Carolina Theater. Douglas Young is the programming director, and Kathy Bisson is CEO and president of the Foundation for the Carolinas. We came to you today from the stage of the Carolina Theater. It is unbelievably beautiful. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.